Support for the Splendid Table podcast provided by Muir Glen Organic Tomatoes, sun-sweetened, picked in late summer and canned the same day to preserve their fresh, vine-ripened flavor. Online at muirglen.com.
It's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by American Public Media and brought to you by Super Target. Well, today it's eating Vietnamese, but getting more from the experience by digging into its lore, as in going back 4,000 years to a prince from the sea. Our guest is Andrea Nguyen, author of Into the Vietnamese Kitchen. Esquire Magazine's Francine Marukian has new takes on mail-order favorites, the coffees, chocolates, and condiments you might not find on your own. Next, we really get into mail-order food, as in Inside the Warehouse in the Middle of the Holiday Rush. Food & Wine Magazine has tallied up the exciting new wines and spirits of 2006. And as always, in the second half of the show, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. The number is 800-537-5252. Oh, hey, we want to welcome a new station, Washington, D.C.'s WAMU. Hey, it's good to have you with us. Okay, let's roll with Jane and Michael Stern. They write the Road Food column in Gourmet Magazine. Hey, Jane, Michael, you've been in one of my favorite states, West Virginia. What have you turned up?
We were in Moundsville, West Virginia, and we came across one of those restaurants that just sets our heart singing. It's called Ho Cuts Barbecue, and it has many, many things to recommend it. But one of the very best things on the menu is hush puppies. And I asked Travis Ho Cut to tell us about his hush puppies.
It's a recipe that my grandmother had for years and years and years. And it's a very simple recipe, and a lot of people ask me, hey, can you give me that recipe? And I tell them, if you eat it long enough, you'll eventually figure it out. I don't give nobody the recipe, and I don't let anybody do my cooking in my kitchen. If I'm not here and I can't cook, we ain't open.
This is a man after my own heart.
Don't you love that?
I love it.
You know, I could eat his hush puppies until I'm 150 years old, and I can tell you I could not figure out how to do them.
What do they taste like, though?
Okay, well, they're little cornmeal fritters.
They're small hush puppies and kind of gnarled and oddly shaped. Like, they're probably equal amounts crunchy exterior and creamy interior.
Mm-hmm. And what's really kind of wonderful, and I have never seen this before, is he brings you a cup of molasses butter or honey butter or just warm butter. So you have three choices to dip them in. And the molasses butter is fabulous.
What a great idea that is, molasses butter.
And it's such a little, tiny, humble place. I mean, I have to just tell you, we went to Moundsville because, you know, we're connoisseurs of prison gift shops.
Yes,
and
yes, I remember this.
Now defunct West Virginia State Penitentiary, which is without a doubt the scariest looking building I've ever seen in my life. It's like a gothic haunted house, is right across from Ho Cuts Barbecue. So the fact that we found great food was just a lagniappe.
But you said there were many things to recommend the place.
Well, the very least is barbecue. I mean, it's right up there with the hush puppies. And even though we're in West Virginia, the man who owns this place is from North Carolina. So he serves this great peppery vinegar marinated pork butt with coleslaw on it.
And in fact, he makes a point of the fact that there is no barbecue sauce in his restaurant. You get the barbecue, it is already moist enough and flavored enough that he does not want you using any sauce on it.
Right? You know, it's not every day that Michael and I find a four-star barbecue that nobody has ever talked about or written about. And this is really the first that I think any of your listeners, unless they live in Moundsville, West Virginia, will probably have heard of this place.
Oh, this sounds good. Hey, guys, thank you.
Oh, you're welcome.
Bye, Lynn.
Bye.
Stick shifts and safety belts. Bucket seats have all got to go when we're driving. In the car, it makes my baby seem so far. I need you here with me, not way over in a bucket seat. I need you to be here with me, not way over. way over in a bucket seat.
Jane and Michael Stern are the authors of Two for the Road. Now, you can hear the Sterns right here every week, but you can get their food finds anytime. You know where. SplendidTable.org. Well, I'm in the middle of an olive oil fanatic's dilemma. The best ones, you know, are dated because oil is in prime condition the first year of its life, and then it fades. Well, here's my dilemma. The 2006 olive harvest is now in the Northern Hemisphere. I mean, except for a handful of the Nuvellos or just-pressed oils, everything available is too old to buy now. Well, here's a solution. Head to the Southern Hemisphere. Their oils were harvested in the summer, at least our summer, and they're still in good shape. Now, I've taste-tested four oils from one supplier I like, the Organic Olive Oil Company. They're in Michigan. Field Reichart, who has the company, imports oils from both sides of the equator, but he's got oils from Argentina, New Zealand, and Australia. Now, I have tasting notes I've put up on the website, along with two other suppliers to check out. So don't spend money on oils that are sort of, you know, going over. Go south. But first, go to the website, splendidtable.org. Food writer Francine Maroukian looks for the take, or the food, or that bit of information that gives you a different slant, maybe a new insight. She's someone I like to check in with often because she's always turning up new stuff. Francine, welcome.
Nice to be here.
I understand you've been doing some test runs on foods to mail order for the holidays. So what have you turned up?
Well, I took all the old traditional categories that people have been sending as gifts for years, and I found new vendors for them. For example, coffee, always a big holiday basket gift.
Yeah, yeah.
There's a coffee roaster in Chicago called Intelligentsia, and they're doing something really interesting. They're taking the blends that the big-time chefs use in their restaurants, and they're making them available for retail on their website. So you can now have the coffee that Paul Kahan has specifically blended for his food at Blackbird, or that Grant Achez is using at Alinea, or Charlie Trotter's blend, or the blend from Frontera. And I think it's really interesting, especially for people who consider coffee to be a big part of their meal.
You know, the thing I like about this, too, we're so chef-conscious these days. And
totally.
For people who are really into that kind of thing, I think this is a great gift. It's sort of a wink in a way.
Totally. You can't get to the restaurant to spend $400 for dinner, but you can have the coffee.
And that I could afford. Exactly.
Totally.
So another category.
Of course, chocolate. People always give chocolate for the holidays. But I'm moving away from exotically flavored chocolate, and I'm coming home to old-fashioned, traditional American chocolates. Now, there is a vendor in the Reading Terminal in Philadelphia.
Mm-hmm.
His name is Michael Houlihan. And what he does is he makes it possible for the best local family chocolatiers to reach a national audience. These are small, small companies. They've been making chocolate for a long time. Not all of them mail order, but you can get them all through him. And he sells really great things, the kind of things I like to have at the holidays. He sells things like almond bark and malted milk balls and nonpareils and butter toffee crunch and all those really sentimental, naive chocolates, I call them.
And they're really high-end in the sense that they're made with great chocolate.
Well, they're still, you know, they're not mass-produced. They're still made by hand by chocolatiers, but it's just a different kind of chocolate. We have gone so far over into the exotic combination like wasabi truffles. I'm just not interested in eating those anymore.
I have never turned down good almond bark in my life.
Oh,
no, I think you've nailed something here because we do get so obsessed with the other end of the chocolate spectrum. What about any other sweet stuff? Because, boy, this is the season for it.
Well, definitely gelato. Gelato is standing in for the old American sort of ice cream and ice cream cake and ice cream logs that people used to cut for the holidays. There are two different gelato makers in America who are turning out unbelievable product. It's more than small batch. It's more than local ingredients. It's real, true flavor. And those people are Cappagero Gelato, again in Philadelphia, and the Il Laboratorio del Gelato on the Lower East Side in New York. And mm-hmm. at this time of the year, you're able to get chestnut, pumpkin, fig, Turkish coffee, pear and wild turkey, blood orange sorbet, cranberry sorbet, and they just, the shipping is incredible. I get these gelatos and ice creams from these people in the middle of the summer, and they arrive in perfect shape. They're just spot on.
Sounds great. What about condiments? What about, because what I'm thinking is you've got, everybody these days is looking at what do you serve with the cheese and that kind of thing. So any condiment
picks. It's true. People are taking that sort of, you know, what we call a trip around the kitchen, salami and cheese and, you know, sliced ham and whatever people tend to have during the holidays. And they're making everything across the board better. They're using locally made charcuterie and fantastic ham, and the accompaniment should match the quality. So I've found a few things that I think really make a difference. One, there's a young woman in Northern California. Her company is called Lulu's Garden, and she's making two fantastic savory products. Italian sweet and sour fruits. She takes dried figs. They're organic. Dried figs and pears and apricots and raisins. Soaks them in red wine and balsamic vinegar with cinnamon and bay leaf and garlic. It's such a savory combination. I often take it and rough chop it, and I stuff it in between the skin and the meat on a chicken or a duck when I roast it. And so that, I mean, it just
sounds
really
good.
Makes a charcuterie platter sing. She also does fantastic sweet tart whole cherries with allspice and bay leaf. And you can take the syrup from those and reduce them and also serve it as a sauce on duck. And outside of Philadelphia, a small company here making incredibly delicious, they call them Philly fresh pickles in both a hot and mild. Very crunchy, very crisp.
I have never met a pickle I didn't like.
Well, then you're going to love these, because these pickles are going to bite you back. They are so crunchy.
Francine, you have really covered the waterfront. Thank you.
Good to talk to you again, Lynn.
Food writer Francine Marukian is contributing editor to Esquire magazine. Her latest book is Chef's Secrets, Insider Techniques from Today's Culinary Masters. Now, you can find Francine's mail order picks on the website, splendidtable.org. And while you're there, be sure to register for our e-newsletters. Now, we have two for you, the Classic Weeknight Kitchen and, for a limited time, Baker's Chronicle. It's a weekly e-newsletter devoted to bakers and baker wannabes. Now, every week you get a new recipe, and as usual, both of them are free. So sign up, splendidtable.org. Coming up, Vietnamese cuisine beyond the recipe, the $7 Wonder Wine, and the doggy bag dilemma. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show about life's appetites. Our show is brought to you by Super Target, home of Archer Farms, where you can find new takes on ethnic classics like salsa, chorizo, and black beans. Find them online at target.com/supertarget. War zone to vacation destination. This is one of the remarkable ways Vietnam has transformed itself in a matter of years. She's done this before, many times before. Now, if you want to get into what Vietnamese food is about, you must have some grasp of her past, the reasons behind the food.
Food writer and cooking teacher Andrea Nguyen has brought the two together in her book, Into the Vietnamese Kitchen, Treasured Foodways, Modern Flavors. Andrea, welcome.
Thank you very much.
So, Andrea, you grew up in Vietnam?
Well, you know, I was born in Vietnam, and my family left 1 week before the fall of Saigon in April 1975. We were fortunate to be able to fly out of Saigon, to tell you the truth, and then we flew to Guam, and from Guam, then we flew to Camp Pendleton in Southern California, which was really one of the first refugee resettlement camps in the United States.
How long did it take your family to adjust in America? I mean, to actually recreate a life here?
It took, you know, quite a while. And at first, it was extremely difficult. My parents were in their 40s, and they had five children with them. And, you know, they abandoned pretty much everything, their identity, their social status, their careers, to come to the United States to start over. And it was difficult to negotiate, you know, this whole new society that was here. And so there was a lot of difficulty.
And that was at a time when it wasn't as though there were already Vietnamese communities that had been established here as there is now. It was a time when you really were establishing those communities.
Exactly. Exactly. For example, you know, the first thing that we did was to go to a local supermarket. And, you know, back then in 1975, we're talking the summer of 1975, essentially, there was no fish sauce available in mainstream supermarkets. There was unremarkable rice. And we pretty much, you know, ate just regular long grain rice and soy sauce for a while.
Very, very different from today, isn't it?
Exactly.
Let's go back to the beginnings of Vietnam. I want to understand the food, you know, as it sits in the culture. How did Vietnam begin? I know that China is at its northern border. Was it originally a part of China?
Well, you know, the Chinese love to say you were all Chinese at one time.
In fact, half the world was Chinese at one time.
Yes, you know, they are the Middle Kingdom. But, you know, what's so interesting about Vietnamese civilization is that when you go all the way back to sort of like these legends and creation myths that are part of Vietnamese lore, there is this interesting story that Vietnamese people were the children of a prince of the sea named Lac Long Quan and a fairy from the northern borders, presumably China, that is. And their oldest son becomes the first king of Vietnam. And so when you take a look at that, there are certain elements in a legend like that that really points you to certain culinary significance. The first one is that Vietnamese cuisine is rice-based, and it's also based upon ingredients from the ocean, such as fish sauce. And then on top of that, you have a lot of foreign intruders, such as China, having been there for like 1,000 years subsequently, and then European and Southeast Asian, as well as Indian influences, and the Vietnamese pattern of folding those cultural influences into their culture, and eventually you taste it in the cuisine. So that's why in the pantry, you see, you've got fish sauce, soy sauce, coconut milk, lemongrass, and curry powder, for example.
And all of that because of the invaders. I'm just thinking, the two things that come to mind as you're explaining this is, first of all, it's this long, narrow country. It must be very hard to keep invaders out because you're so vulnerable on so many borders. But the other thing, you know, on this side of the Pacific, when we think of the influences on Vietnamese food, we think of France. But you're saying perhaps this is not one of the great influences on the cuisine.
No, you know, I think that what we have to ask ourselves is, well, you know, the French missionaries started arriving in the 16th century, and French colonization was officially from like the late 1870s to 1954. So what were the Vietnamese eating before that? Before the French arrived? I think that that's a very, you know, a rational question to ask. And they were eating many other foods that were indigenous to the areas, you know, a lot of these fresh herbs and lettuces and rice as well.
Right.
And the other thing that one needs to remember about Vietnam is that it really started in the northern part of what is now the entire long S-shaped country. So we've got that S-shaped country now, but that didn't really exist until around 1800, to tell you the truth. So we've got three regions, and northern Vietnam really is more strongly influenced by Chinese culture and food ways. So you have the use of star anise in a bowl of noodle soup like pho. And some people even say that pho may have come from the French preparation of pot-au-feu. But a lot of people say that
the broth that you cook the beef in the vegetables
exactly,
in.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. Since the French started slaughtering so many cows to render their beef steaks, which they enjoyed so much, the Vietnamese were left with the scraps, with the bones and with the, you know, really tough cuts. And then so they made dishes like the beef noodle soup. And then in the central region, it's very narrow. There's like, you know, about the narrowest point's about 30 miles wide. And so people there really use very minimal agricultural resources to produce a noodle soup called bún bò Huế, which is spicy and it's gutsy and it's chewy and it's got beef and it's got pork. So that really reflects more of their cultural background. And then you've got in the south, which is influenced by Indian and more of those southern, you know, Southeast Asian like Cambodia and Thailand, those cultures, you've got a different noodle soup called Hủ tiếu Nam Vang, which is a Phnom Penh noodle soup. And if you think of Vietnam in terms of those three noodle soups, you can really get a sense of how the regional differences get played out culinarily.
The regions of a country in three noodle soups. Hey, thank you so much, Andrea.
Thank you, Lynn.
Andrea Nguyen is author of Into the Vietnamese Kitchen, Treasured Foodways, Modern Flavors. Well, a good foundation recipe to start you making Vietnamese noodle soup is Andrea's chicken and cellophane noodle soup. It's from the Saigon Marketplace. Find the recipe at splendidtable.org. You know, you can get to us another way and meet like minds along the way. It's simple. Join our food talk group on gather.com. It's an online space to ask questions and trade recipes. Head to splendidtable.org and click on Food Talk. Zingerman's Deli put Ann Arbor, Michigan on the culinary map. Now, I know that there are other worth-the-journey experiences in Michigan, but Zingerman's is the area's calling card to the food world. Now, the deli started in 1982. 24 years and a 24,000-square-foot warehouse later, Zingerman's is a major player in specialty mail order. And right now, it is the season. All they have to do is survive it. Kyle Norris stepped into the warehouse on a typical December day.
Good. Excellent.
Jude Walton is a small British woman who wears a black trench coat, smokes cigarettes, and drinks a stream of Diet Coke. She's one of the four managing partners at Zingerman's Mail Order. In December, you can find Jude zooming around Mail Order's 24,000-square-foot warehouse. During a quiet moment, she's standing near a pole in the center of the warehouse, and she's pointing out some of the building's features.
All right, well, right now I'm starting out looking forward, and I'm looking at an unbelievably large amount of wooden boxes. We actually received 22 pallets this morning at 7 a.m., which was fun, but a very nice driver, which actually does make it fun. So I'm looking at a huge bank of packaging and items set up. Kind of turning around a little bit, I'm looking over towards our break room, which seemed so big when we built it, and we can barely seat everybody for lunch already.
That break room can't hold all of its employees, because during the holiday, Mail Order will increase its staff by 300 people. The organization will do about half of its yearly business, that's $4 million in sales, during the 2 weeks just before Christmas. As Jude gives her warehouse tour, she describes the layout that makes this operation possible. She points out a conveyor line which snakes through the center of the room. Above the line hangs a tube-like machine which holds small airbags. People in packaging will grab these airbags, which look like a child's bright orange water wings, and they'll stuff them into boxes. Now, Jude's describing the cheese room.
that is a pretty overloaded room right now. A lot of the cheese, of course, being imported, we bring in a little bit early so that we can hold it and maintain it here. And so that cheese room is bulging right now, to say the least. It looks like an overly ripe camembert. And then coming back round, it's a bit of a boring corner because it's really just the walls of the offices and everything. But we're already at the point where I think we have 25 or 30 people on the phones taking orders, and it is definitely hopping in there.
Hopping is definitely the right word to describe what this place will look like. And hopping will probably morph into hectic. The atmosphere and speed at which things can happen can be a lot to handle for new employees. Zingerman's buffers these factors by providing things like mandatory breaks, healthy snacks, an employee help phone line, and best of all, an employee meal. For each shift they work, employees get a hot meal like meatloaf and mashed potatoes. Theodore Price is a returning seasonal employee who says the meals are a highlight.
It makes me feel appreciated, actually, because not too many companies that do this. So it's a blessing.
Seasonal employees must take a class which introduces them to mail order. Tom Root, another managing partner, teaches the class. He tells his class that about 95% of the boxes they ship over the holidays are actually gifts from one person to another.
So I want you to think about the fact that really what you're doing is helping two people communicate with each other. And every box that goes through your hands and every coffee cake and loaf of bread that you bag is meant to represent one person's feelings for another person during this holiday season.
Tom says he thinks employees will approach their jobs differently if they keep this in mind. I've worked the holiday rush several times, and one of the things that kept me going during some of those more hectic moments was imagining the faces of the people receiving these gifts. I'd picture how their expressions would light up and how happy they must feel to get such cool things. Jude Walton has an annual ritual she likes to do during the holiday rush.
Every year there's always one or two moments where I remember where I just sort of stop and stand still for a second, usually at that pole in the middle of the floor, and just kind of look around. And it's, you know, it's a controlled chaos that's quite impressive to see. I wish I could describe it better, but you really kind of almost have to be there in the moment to really understand what it's like and how we got here.
She says she feels proud, knowing an improbably small number of people have turned out an incredible amount of work and shipped out a lot of food in a very short period of time.
Kyle Norris is a writer and producer who lives in Ann Arbor. Well, if you live in Scandinavian territory like Minnesota, December feels like lefse season. Lefse is a thin, thin pancake made with a potato sweet cream dough. You warm it, slather it with butter, sprinkle on sugar and cinnamon, and roll it up like a cigar. People work for years to get their lefse right. Well, last year, Amy, my friend, brought her dad's lefse in. It was outstanding, so I asked if he would share the recipe with us. Well, Amy's dad actually wrote it up. Ernie Crippen of Ten Strike, Minnesota, is 84 years old and has been making lefse for over 20 years. He took over when Amy's grandmom passed away in 1984. Well, many thanks, Mr. Crippen. I have put Ernie Crippen's lefse recipe on the website, but one word of advice, read the entire thing before starting. Find it on splendidtable.org. You know, wine and spirits, like food, have their yearly turns. Now, remember when, if it wasn't French or Californian, it couldn't possibly be good enough for the experts? But viniferous boundaries have been pushed far beyond those two countries. And every month, Food & Wine magazine's senior wine editor, Ray Isle, explores those new boundaries. Now, he has his most exciting new wines and spirits of 2006. Ray, welcome back.
It's great to be back, Lynn. Thanks.
So in 2006, let's talk wine first. Any seismic shifts?
Yeah. In fact, the one seismic shift is what you were talking about, that the boundaries of what's available out there and what people are trying just keep expanding almost geometrically, it seems, or geographically either way.
Uh-huh.
And the single best inexpensive red I found this year is from Spain. And more to the point, it's from a completely effectively, you know, unknown until a few years ago region of Spain. It's a wonderful wine called the 2005 Garnacha de Fuego from Bodegas Ateca. It's about, retail it lists for about $7. You can find it for $6 or even less. And it's just gorgeous stuff. Intense, deep flavors. Wonderful wine from the Calatayud region, which is west of Madrid. And this is what's happened in Spain. It's fascinating. The wine's been grown in Calatayud for 2,000 years, but
so they have an idea of what they're doing.
They kind of got it figured out. They're doing a pretty good job. You've got these affordable wines coming out of Spain, and some of the other southern Italy is another case in point, which are made from amazing vine material, 80, 60, 80, 100-year-old vines, but yet cost $7, $8, $10, and you can find some astonishing deals. This one case is exactly that. I tasted it and thought, this is absurd. This can't be $7. I should have invested in this.
Why did I know about this 5 years ago? Yeah, I could have made my fortune. What about the spirit side of this past year?
On the spirits side this past year, there's always a couple of great new spirits that don't necessarily represent a trend. There's a wonderful rum that came out this year from a company called De Paz, which is out of Martinique. They also, at the same time, released bottled cane syrup, which is nice. It's a fresh cane syrup sweetener, which is a great mixer, and you can kind of buy the two together. Glenmorangie released an extraordinarily good scotch, Margaux finish.
What is that
scotch?
Mean?
They age the scotch as usual in bourbon barrels, in white oak, and then for a limited time after that, they age it in barrels that came directly from Chateau Margaux, the first growth Bordeaux property.
Right,
and it imparts a very subtle, kind of slight fruit and wine character to the scotch. It's extraordinarily good scotch. It's unfortunately extraordinarily expensive, about $500 a bottle.
Whoa. Okay. But, all right. So this is the one – this is the splurge to end all splurge. But these people are famous for single malt scotches.
Yes.
This idea of finishing a scotch in a Margaux barrel – Chateau Margaux has been thought of as being one of the great red wines, of the world.
Yeah, obviously several hundred years. And Glenmorangie was really at the start of this idea of finishing in different barrels. And the other thing that's happened in spirits this year is there's been a resurgence in rye, which is kind of, one of the classic American spirits. And Rittenhouse, which is was a fairly little-known brand, has become the kind of darling of cocktail mixologists around the country. And they make a Rittenhouse 100-proof rye that is just super if you happen to like making Manhattans, a perfect, winter drink.
What does rye taste like?
Rye is similar to bourbon. It's a spicier, a little less sweet. It has less of the vanillin characteristics of bourbon. It has a little more spice. It's a little more aggressive. And it's a little harsher on its own, but as a mixer, it's one reason Manhattans were originally made with rye is because you're mixing them with sweet vermouth. And that balance of the spicy, slightly, perky element of rye, I guess you'd say, with the sweet vermouth really works out extraordinarily well. Rye is, its moment has come again, since its original moment was, I suppose, in 1850 or something.
So we're going back in time and finding wine barrels with phenomenal scotch in them. Hey, thank you, Ray.
Thank you, Lynn. It's a pleasure to be here as always.
Ray Isle is senior wine editor at Food & Wine magazine. Now, his article on the most exciting new wines of 2006 appeared in the December 2006 issue of the magazine. You can find Ray's Spirit & Wine picks, where, on the website, splendidtable.org. Well, it's time for this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question is, what Polish woman is responsible for a luscious, if phony, Danish legacy? We're going to have that answer in a moment, and we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can get to us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media.
Thank you.
I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Super Target, a grocery store and Target all in one, where guests can have their cake and a plate to eat it on, too. Online at Target.com/SuperTarget. Now, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls in a moment. You can get to us at 800-537-5252. But first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question was, what Polish woman is responsible for a luscious, if phony, Danish legacy? Well, it was Rose Mattis. With her husband, Ruben, she created Häagen-Dazs ice cream. Now, evidently, Ruben was the master ice cream maker and Rose was the marketing genius. After selling the family ice cream for 30 years to local stores, in 1960, they had this idea of changing their brand name to something that sounded Danish. Now, why Danish? I have no idea. But it was a completely made-up name, Häagen-Dazs. Well, they were the first people to sell upscale ice cream in national supermarkets. They created essentially a kingdom. Well, Rose Mattis passed away recently at 90 years old.
If you're feeling sad and lonely, there's a service I can render. Tell the one who loves you only I can be so warm and tender. Call me, don't be afraid, you can call me.
It's time for your calls brought to you by Muir Glen Organic Tomatoes. Tomatoes true to nature. Pick up that phone, guys. Number's 800-537-5252. Let's see. We have got Philip on the line from Edenton, North Carolina. Philip, what do you want to talk about?
Thank you. Nice to talk to you, Lynn. I'm a great advocate of your program. So
thank you. Thank you.
This is quite a privilege. I want to talk about bacon. And I'm perplexed because the kind of pork that I can find, whether it's pork or bacon, is nothing like what it was when I was living back in England. You can't find back bacon here. You can only find the stuff which comes from the much vaunted pork bellies.
Right, right.
And back bacon is so superior.
Could you explain what you think of as back bacon?
Yeah, it comes from the back of the pig.
So it's got a lot of meat.
It's got a lot of meat on it. It has relatively a small amount of fat. It's extremely tasty. And you don't cook it until it, splits apart like crackling. You cook it lightly. And it's delicious.
Can I ask you, because you know what I think you're talking about? Back bacon, I think, is made from the pork loin.
Ah.
It's made actually from that top, very pricey part of the pig. Where the
it is more expensive than the stripy variety. There's no question about it.
And it is, does Canadian bacon come close for you?
Have no,
you
tried, not really.
You know why? I think because Canadian bacon has almost no fat, right?
Yes, that's true.
Yeah. First of all, there's got to be some place online where you can mail order this. You know, there's got to be, there has to be somebody in this country, because it's hard to get pork products from abroad. But there's got to be somebody in this country who's making it. And there may be actually some way of ordering it directly from England. But the other thing that occurs to me is that if there are any butchers out there who are smoking their own pork that are smoking the pork chops, you may be coming close to that experience. But it's hard to duplicate it. I think you got to go online. You've got to mail order it.
Yeah.
I'm sorry we've let you down.
No, you haven't at all. It's been most entertaining. But, I do wish somebody would take it up.
You know, BritishBacon.com comes to mind. I have no idea if that's really a website, but you know what?
Yeah.
Just try BritishBacon.com for fun and see what happens.
Okay.
Okay. I would bet you somebody is doing this.
Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you for calling. Okay. Take care.
Bye-bye.
back bacon. It's really like it's boneless. Like imagine a boneless pork chop, and you know it's shaped like a big comma, and it has a tail on it with more fat, and it has a layer of fat on it, but it's lean meat in the center. And I think Canadian bacon is, well, that fat is trimmed away, and you're just left with the lean meat, which frankly I find boring. Anyway, 800-537-5252. That's how you can call us. We've got Stephen calling. Now, this call comes to us through our discussion group on Gathered.com. Hey, Stephen, what do you want to talk about?
Thanks, Lynn. My mother used to warm up our hard rolls, the dinner rolls that we used to have for the holiday meals when we had all the relatives over.
Right.
By putting them in just a plain brown grocery bag that she kind of, sprinkled a little water on just to kind of get it a little bit of damp.
Mm-hmm.
And then putting it in the oven and turning off the oven and just letting them sit while we were carving the turkey or whatever, and they would warm up and then she would serve them at the table. But now I keep thinking that a few years ago that I either read or heard somewhere that this wasn't a good thing to do anymore because of the recycled materials that they're using now in the grocery bags that you get and stuff. And that putting food in there, it might contaminate the food.
Yeah.
And then, of course, then we eat the food, you know?
I think I would be concerned. And I think you can easily heat them up without being in the bag. You know, you can just put them on the oven rack.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the, you know, I grew up in a family where nobody threw away bread. And my grandmother had a way that she sort of resuscitated bread that had started to get a little stale. And what she would do is she'd sprinkle the bread with the water and put it in the oven. And it was interesting because it brought it back. You know, it almost re-moisturized it. It didn't get soppy because you left it in the oven until it crisped a bit. But I would say don't use the bag.
Don't use the bag?
Don't use the bag.
Okay.
I just don't know. You know, it's sort of like if there's a chance, why take a chance?
Yeah. Okay.
Hey, thanks for a great question.
Thank you.
You take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. We have Bill calling from Fort Collins, Colorado. Hey, Bill, what's up? What do you want to talk about?
Well, we just got back from a trip of Northern Europe and driving around, and we were driving through Flanders and stopped in a place called Ypres, Belgium.
Oh, yes, yes. Very, yeah, yeah.
They had outside one of the chocolate shops, there was a lady making Belgium waffles You know, it's like you watch them making waffles, but they weren't using a batter. Rather, they were using a yeast dough.
Uh-huh.
And we're going, okay, how do you make those delicious, doughy, heavy, you know, the chocolate frosting, pour on powdered sugar and whipped cream on top special?
Well, did she have it with whipped cream on top?
You could get it with whipped cream. You could get it with powdered sugar, with chocolate, almost like a chocolate frosting that she'd pour, and then she'd even top it with whipped cream.
Well, I have to tell you, after this is where I'm going to sound like such a snob. After living 5 years in Belgium, I can tell you she's bastardizing a great tradition. No, the Belgian waffle that, you were in Belgium. And,
yeah.
You know, Belgium is divided between the Flemish side and the French side. And in the French side, they do a waffle that is lighter. Closer to what we think of as a Belgian waffle, and they do sometimes put fruit and cream on it. But generally speaking, again, there's always exceptions. What you had is the great tradition. We used to get them living in Brussels all the time. There were little windows, you know, on the sides of stores, and there would be a man who you'd hand him your money, and he'd hand you hot, crusty from the waffle iron, sort of round, deeply indented, coated with sticky sugar and chunks of sticky sugar in it.
That's
waffles.
It.
And probably there was chocolate back there that it could be dipped in. I just never got that far. And they were heavy like lead, and they were the best thing you've ever put in your mouth. Does this sound familiar?
That sounds exactly right.
Okay, it's a sweet dough. And it's basically, your basic idea here is that you take any basic yeasted coffee cake dough, you know, where you'd have some fat in it like butter. You'd have a bit of sugar. It would be white flour. It would be milk. And you knead that and you let it rise for a bit. And then you have it sitting there, you know, mostly risen. And you take a ball of it and you press it into the hot iron that you've brushed, you know, with fat. And you cook it with the other part of the iron on top of it. But you also have broken up, they call it loaf sugar there, which can be almost like a brown sugar. But you could use crystal sugar. You could use sugar cubes. But the idea is that there were lumps of sugar in the batter, too, sometimes, or in the dough. But it's a great tradition in the Flemish part of Belgium, and it's called gaufre, G-A-U-F-R-E-S. And all over Europe, if you look closely, you find there are all different kinds of versions of this idea of something cooked between two pieces of iron. And if you go to places, sometimes they're flat. They're actual wafers, you know? And in the old days, every family had its own irons, and they would have their family crest or their monogram or some design that was symbolic of their family. And then during the holidays, they would make their own wafers or waffles with this impression in it. And it's a great old tradition. But I'd say you can start out with almost any sweet yeast dough and give it a shot.
Okay.
Yeah.
What type of iron, how deep of iron should I use?
Well, you know, you could use a standard iron. You just wouldn't make them too thick. But the typical Belgian waffle iron is one with very deep indentations in it, deeper than our standard iron. And I have a feeling they're out there. I haven't made a Belgian waffle in a long time, but I have a feeling they're out there. And if you look up a Liège or a French version of the Belgian waffle, Liège is a city in the French part of the country, okay. L-I-E-G-E, you'll find a slightly lighter version. And if I remember, it's still yeast. It's just not quite as heavy, and it's a bit thinner and crisper.
Okay.
I could be wrong about that. But the whipped cream business, in all the years we lived in Belgium, and I just may have missed this, I think I saw a waffle with whipped cream on it once. And I kept wondering, where's the whipped cream? What these people, they don't know they're supposed to have whipped cream and fruit on their waffles. But the point is, it really has always been street food in Belgium. Mm-hmm. And boy, you're making me sort of long to be back there. Especially in winter, because they were great hand warmers. Great. Yeah. Hey, Bill, thank you for bringing back memories.
Thank you, Lynn.
You take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye. We hear plastic or paper all the time in the grocery store, but almost never in the restaurant or at the takeout counter. Less home cooking and huge portion sizes are becoming the bad guys in the ecology department. I mean, the doggy bag is not a paper bag. We're schlepping home a lot more food in a lot of styrofoam containers. Well, Dan Oko, who writes for Mother Jones, checked into the takeout doggy bag question. Dan, welcome.
Thank you.
So, Dan, how is this all playing in the recycling area?
Well, that's, I think, part of the puzzle. You know, most people, I think, take care of their home recycling, but when it comes to, takeout food, and the most obvious places when we're driving through, any given fast food restaurant drive-through, you end up with what ostensibly is garbage. The problem, of course, when you deal with restaurants is that sometimes they're not even using plastics or recycled stuff. There's so much styrofoam still that tends to get handed out, at least in my hometown of Austin, Texas, that, that becomes the major issue, is not so much a recycling of these takeaway containers as actually just they just end up in the landfill.
Yeah, because styrofoam does not recycle, right?
Most does not recycle. There are some new polymers they're using, some vegetable based, again, plastics or mm-hmm. styrofoam, if you will. Although, as I was warned by somebody, a lot of them are advertised as being compostable as opposed to recyclable. And the problem is that very little that goes to the landfill gets composted because of the technology that they're using now for our dumps has to do with basically sealing these boxes, especially if they've been contaminated with foodstuffs. The landfill is no longer a open-air depository for our garbage. It's it's a sealed. It ends up being a sealed container, so there's no chance for that garbage to break down.
Is there any area in the restaurant world where this is being addressed, materials that are being developed that restaurants have access to that make it a little better?
Absolutely. Earlier this year, the big news was that Starbucks, which obviously hands out a lot of coffee cups, has started to incorporate post-consumer recycled materials into their cups so that they've mm-hmm. begun to save quite a bit of paper and begun to recycle quite a bit of paper. This has had a broader impact on other companies that can now avail themselves of this recycled material for their food containers. It was actually a bit of a breakthrough because the FDA had not approved previously these post-consumer recycled products for food.
So is there any way we can know? I mean, we as a consumer, we want to take the doggy bag home. We want to pick up a takeout meal. Is there anything we personally can do on a day-to-day basis?
Well, one of the things that everybody recommends is talking to your local restaurants and finding out what they're using or not using in their takeout containers. McDonald's, 15 years ago, essentially replaced their styrofoam sandwich boxes, which is what I remember from a kid, and now when you go and get a Big Mac, even, you get a cardboard box.
Mm.
Some of the larger companies are surprising us by taking a more ecological approach to these problems than smaller restaurants that, you know, are really looking at the bottom line.
Yeah.
But what you're pointing to is the consumer consciousness, which is if you have a local coffee shop that you like to go to, you can ask them if their cups are post-consumer or what they're made out of. There's a group called the Green Restaurant Association that actually has little wallet-sized cards that you can print out and leave with a bill if you want to indicate that you're, you know, interested in patronizing, again, sort of more ecologically inclined or greener restaurants.
Hmm. That's a great idea. Dan, thank you.
No problem.
Dan Oko's article, The Doggy Bag Dilemma, appeared in the November-December 2006 issue of Mother Jones Magazine. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for joining us. Remember, you can call us anytime. The number is 800-537-5252. And until next week, let me leave you with this thought from Samuel Beckett. He said, "Probably nothing in the world arouses more false hopes than the first 4 hours of a diet." The Splendid Table is produced by American Public Media and brought to you by SuperTarget. Now, everything you heard here today, solutions for life's little problems, and so much more, can be found at our website, splendidtable.org. And while you're there, be sure to sign up for our weekly e-newsletters. Weeknight Kitchen is our attempt to simplify your kitchen life midweek, and Baker's Chronicle will get you baking over the weekend. Now, you can also download our weekly podcast. Sign up for it online, splendidtable.org. The Splendid Table is supported by Muir Glen Organic Tomatoes, sun-sweetened, picked in late summer, and canned the same day to preserve their fresh, vine-ripened flavor. Recipes online at muirglen.com. Muir Glen Tomatoes, true to nature. Our producers are Sally Swift and Jennifer Russell, with intern help from Alexis Donath. Our technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Judy Graham and Jeff Harkness. Thanks for tuning in. Join us next week, and have a great week. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
American Public Media.